The Reserve Pool, Episode 40, Rot. Hello, everybody, and welcome to the 40th episode of The Reserve Pool. I'm not emphasizing that it's the 40th because it's special, though I guess we should be hitting our midlife crisis soon, but we're very happy to be here with you another week. I am, of course, Dave.
And I am Evan, and I hear the Reserve Pool is looking into buying a sports car because midlife crisis. No, terrible.
It's possible. But this is not a podcast about cars. If you want that, you should check out Click and Clack, the Tappert Brothers. This is a podcast about Dice Masters and all the people who love to play it. How you doing, Evan?
Pretty well. Cold, because it's still the icy grasp of winter. Though by the time this episode hits, maybe it won't be quite as cold. Yes, it'll be just as cold.
By the time this episode hits, it will be March. So
really?
Yeah.
Oh, man. Yeah, and it's actually going to be like up in the 40s for a lot of March. So maybe it won't be quite as cold. Maybe I'll be able to go walking again. It'll be wonderful.
Tell me about it. We have this riverfront trail by our place, and it's not something you'd expect in a small town like this, but it's there, and I love it. But it is very pretty in winter, but it's also very difficult to get to in winter. But
it'd be nice. There's a track that the library about a not even a block from me has right. Like a little like loop for walking behind it. It's like half a mile long, and it's not, they don't shovel it or anything, and sidewalks. Ooh. Over here, so it's completely impossible to get to. There's just like 6 inches of frozen snow.
Well, they don't shovel the sidewalks except for whatever was happening at the beginning of last episode.
No, they shovel the sidewalks like across by my apartments, but not like on the street.
I gotcha. Fair enough. So, well, we've taken advantage of some of the junky weather recently to play some board games. In fact, yesterday we had a friend in town, a friend who lives in town, come on over, and we played Suburbia, which if you like SimCity, you would love Suburbia. You're laying down these little hex tiles that represent different kinds of developments, whether they're industrial, commercial, residential, or government, and like you get different bonuses, and you're trying to increase your income and also your population. But as your city grows, right, it becomes more expensive to maintain. So the amount at which your income grows and the amount at which your population grows gets set back a little bit, and then you have to kind of push it back forward. But it's great fun. It was our friend Justin's first time playing that game, and basically we were looking at the collection. We played Galaxy Trucker already, and we're just talking about games and stuff, and he says, you know, I really like SimCity. I said, oh, I have Suburbia. You will love this. And he did. He really thought it was cool.
Yeah, I've heard the name but not played it, so I cannot say.
It's a nifty game, and if you do like SimCity, then get that. If you don't like SimCity, there's a similar one by the same designer, actually, called The Castles of Mad King Ludwig. And
Which there's been a lot of in my gaming group lately. I haven't had a chance to play it, but it looks quite interesting.
Yeah, check that out. If you like that on its own, then get that. If you like that but maybe want to separate the fantasy from it, get Suburbia. It's just a neat game. It's not super heavyweight. Scoring can be a little complex, but once you understand it, it's a breeze. And if you're a SimCity fan and would like a board game that gives you that flavor, get Suburbia. It's wonderful.
Yeah, I've been playing. Well, I had another game of Epic Wizard Duel at Mount Skullsfire, which is amazing just because of the title. Also, art by, I believe it's the guy who did Super Jail, which is always fun to look at.
I think you are actually, that's not really the title. I believe the full title is Epic Spell Wars of the Battle Wizards Duel at Mount Skullsfire. Skulls spelled with a Z and a
yes.
Y,
you
so
are
you know
correct.
They're serious.
You are correct.
It's the most ridiculous
board game title. It's a very long
title,
so I abbreviate it sometimes, and by sometimes I mean a lot of the times. But yes, thank you for correcting me.
And the cover
is due.
It's one of my favorite board game covers ever. It looks like, is it Munchkin art? Was that what you were
going to
say?
I, like I said, I think it's the guy who illustrated the cartoon Super Jail, but I'm not 100% sure about that.
That could be. Okay. I like the skull with a volcano on his head that appears to be vomiting either lava or blood.
Yeah, and you actually get a standee of that.
Oh, is that Mount Skull's fire?
Yes.
Itself. Ah, well, it all makes sense.
Regardless, if I'm wrong, it will be identified for all posterity.
Well, hopefully everybody's gotten in some gaming lately. I don't think everyone's gotten the weather that we have in the northeastern part of the country, but perhaps you have, and it's a great excuse for gaming, and if you don't have weather, really, you should be gaming anyway, especially Dice Master. So let's talk some more.
If you don't have weather, you might be on the moon.
Well, that's true, too. But let's talk some more about Dice Masters and see what Randy and Chris have to talk to us about this week.
The Reserve Pool presents. There and back again. A look back at characters from previous sets and seeing how they fit in to newer sets as they're released. Here's your host, Randy. And, again, I have a very special guest.
Abigail.
And today, who are we going to look at, Abigail?
The Thing.
Is The Thing your favorite character?
Yeah.
Your favorite superhero?
Yeah.
Yeah? When you eat your dinner at night, we tell you you're going to grow big and strong like The Thing?
Yeah.
Yeah? The Thing is a part of what team?
The Fantastic Four.
The Fantastic Four. Do you remember his real name?
Ben.
And what does The Thing like to say?
It's clobbering time.
That's right, it's clobbering time. As we mentioned, The Thing, Benjamin Grimm, first appeared in Fantastic Four number 1 in November of 1961. He's been an off-and-on member of the Fantastic Four through his entire comic book career. And in addition to being Abigail's favorite character, he's one of my favorite comic book characters, too.
Hey. Who's one of your favorites on the Fantastic Four?
The Thing is my favorite from the Fantastic Four.
The Human Torch, too?
I do like the Human Torch, but The Thing is my favorite. Human Torch is second favorite. Who's your second favorite? Is it the Invisible Woman?
Yeah.
I thought so. Taking a look at Thing's dye real quick. Yellow dye with the brownish-orange silhouette of the Thing's face. It looks okay. I really think they could have done more with this one. I'd rather have the all-orange dye with maybe a yellow outline, or, I don't know, they could have done something with the color blue since he's on the Fantastic Four. It's not the prettiest looking dye. I think they could have done something different. And usually we start off with the common. Not this time. We are starting off with the rare and working our way down. Idol of Millions. 7 cost, Fantastic Four team ability. When fielded, if your opponent has more fielded characters than you, draw and roll 3 dice. This isn't totally useless. I mean, it's never bad to draw and roll dice. I just think for 7 cost and a total fielding cost of 6, there should be more oomph. This should be more game-breaking than what it is. A 7 cost character with a potential 3 fielding cost should be a game winner. And this character just is not a game winner. The uncommon, Grim Ben, is the cheapest thing we have at 5 cost. At the start of the attack step, if your opponent has more fielded characters than you, Thing gets 3 attack, 3 defense. Not too bad, but it's at the start of the attack step, and they need more characters. With Relentless being able to make characters unable to block, this card is much more useful. And if you were able to give him Overcrush with Thrown Car or maybe a potential upcoming basic action that can grant Overcrush, that +3 attack, +3 defense could go a long way. However, the cream of the crop, the common, ever-loving blue-eyed. At the start of the attack step, what?
There's 6 and 5 and 7.
That's right. This one does cost 6. That one costs 5 and that one costs 7. But we're talking about this one. How much does this one cost?
4.
No, he's on the Fantastic Four team. How much does it cost?
6.
There we go. At the start of the attack step, if your opponent has more fielded characters than you, Thing can't be blocked and takes no damage while blocked. Now, making a character with an 8 attack value unblockable is great. And even if you roll him on a low level, the fact that he takes no damage while blocking that's fine too. 3 attack, 3 defense, but wouldn't be getting knocked out by any attackers, as long as your opponent has more fielded characters than you. I think this one, and possibly the uncommon thing, Grim Ben, they can have a place on team that relies on distraction, which did come out in this set, but definitely plays to the ability of not having as many characters as your opponent. So much like the Doctor Strange we talked about last week, as the game advances and more actions become easier to use and have more of a role, a character like the Thing that benefits from your opponent having more characters in the field than you, there's definitely some room to exploit that. I still don't know how good the Thing is. I mean, is common at 6 cost, potentially unblockable, and is 5 cost that can get beefed up. They're good, and they're good support players moving forward if we can, you know, if we can build a team around some basic actions. But he is one of my favorite characters, and Abigail's number one favorite character, so we will always be looking for a way to incorporate the Thing into our teams. So be sure that if something comes out that the Thing can take advantage of, we will be the first to let you know. This has been Randy and
Abigail
talking about her favorite character,
the Thing.
Thanks for listening. Back to you guys.
This is Chris with a Global Minute. I think we can agree that bolts are a pretty good overall energy type, can't we? There are several good bolt characters and a couple really good ones. Today, I want to talk about a unique global from the Uncanny X-Men set, and it belongs to Iceman. Iceman's global only shows up on one of his starter set common forms, Too Cool for Words. His global reads like this. Pay 1 bolt energy to spend any number of your sidekick dice to their bolt energy side. If active, move them to your reserve pool. The first time I saw this global, I'll admit, I wrote it off. I thought, why would I pay 1 bolt energy to get a few more out of the deal? That was foolish of me. And I've since used it more than once and even employed it on a tournament team. As far as controlling energy rolled and shaping it into what you want it to be, Iceman's global is perfect. So long as you want bolts. Maybe you want more to pump up your heavy hitter with the Enrage Global. Great, you got it. Maybe you'd like to do some indirect killing using Mr. Sinister's hefty 2-bolt cost Global. Well, here you go. What if you've got Cable hanging around on your team and a 1-damage ping along with a nope, you're not blocking me tariff? Sounds really good. Iceman's got your back. He also pairs well with some familiar Avengers vs. X-Men faces, such as Green Goblin Norman Osborn and even the Human Torch Flame On Global. And with Phoenix's nifty little Taunt Global pulling in attackers, you can set yourself up for a nice clean board next round to swing in for some big damage. I like this global for its versatility. Just keep in mind, even though you can change any psychic die on your board into a bolt, the only dice that will actually find their way into your reserve pool are fielded sidekick characters that you change into bolts. Unfortunately, nowhere in the card text does it grant the ability to actually move dice in from used or prepped. In other words, don't let someone try to pull this over on you under your nose. Hey, it's happened before. That's all for now. This has been a Global Minute. Until next time, keep an eye out for that unexpected red text.
This is Taking Action. A periodic look at how to get the most out of your basic and non-basic action cards. Today, we're going to look at a non-basic action that I actually like a lot from the Yu-Gi-Oh! Set. I'm talking about Ring of Magnetism. Now, as a non-basic action, it does give us a specific type of energy, in this case, masks. It also comes to us with a common, uncommon, and rare form. Now, the common is a 4-cost. It's called Sidekick Attraction, and it reads, play on a monster. All opposing sidekicks must attack while that monster is active. Well, let's examine this in terms of quadrant theory. During setup, well, it costs 4. It's a little towards the end of setup, you know, the higher setup costs, and it forces sidekicks to attack. Other than the, you know, the possibility of some specific energy here, I'm not a huge fan of it for that stage of the game. During parity, it's a possible way to clear out sidekicks if your opponents have a wall of sidekicks and that's stopping you from getting through. That could work. When you're losing, I don't know that you want to invite damage unless you are having them block into something that they might regret. For example, you're playing in mixed play and you use Beast 666. So we'll say it's a situational play there. And when you're winning, again, it could clear out some blockers, so maybe it has some uses there. All in all, I give this card a pretty mediocre grade, but it is playable. Let's skip to the rare, because it is also 4 costs, and we're going to knock that out right now, too. The rare, again, 4 to purchase. Play on a monster. Your opponent can only block monsters affected by this die until each such monster with this die has been assigned to blockers. So, that sounds like we're talking in circles, but what it's essentially saying is that every monster that's wearing a Ring of Magnetism has to be double blocked. Nothing else can be blocked until all of them are double blocked. So essentially, you're making anything into a She-Hulk or a Harpy Lady Sisters. Now, again, this has the same caveats in the early game as the common does. During parity, this could really break things up because now your opponent just doesn't have the opportunity to block as well or as effectively. Use this in combination with something like Harpy Lady Sisters in this set, or if you're playing mixed She-Hulk, and you could have some interesting things going on. Of course, when you're losing, it doesn't really change the board in any meaningful way. So I'm not entirely sure that it's going to help you there. And when you're winning, this could help you clear up enough blockers to get that lethal blow through. So this is definitely mid to higher tier in terms of this. Not the highest tier, but definitely mid to higher. I like that a lot. Definitely a step up from the common. But what I really want to talk about today is the uncommon. Now, this has certainly gotten a lot of discussion lately, whether it's here on other blogs like Dice Masters Rules, the Dice Anon podcast was talking a lot about it. And, of course, this was the subject of a recent ruling on the WizKids Rules Forum. So, Ring of Magnetism Action Attraction. I love that name. Play on a monster. Your opponent's action, dice, and abilities can only target that monster. So in some ways, it's like a lure from Magic, except instead of affecting, you know, how things are blocking, it affects how what things can, you know, what things can target you. Well, the interesting play with this is to match it up with Lord of Dragons from Yu-Gi-Oh, which states that action dice and global abilities essentially have no effect on Lord of D. So if you put the ring on the Lord of D, all of a sudden you have a monster that everything must target, and yet nothing has an effect on. That's pretty cool. Now, there are ways around it, and Dice Anon were talking a lot about, you know, the possibility of using Storm, and they agreed it could be a mixed bag, because if you're going to retarget the Ring of Magnetism with Storm, you have to now have a means of removing whatever that thing was that you targeted it, be a sidekick or whatever else. Otherwise, you know, if you're swapping, paying for global abilities, it's going to be about who runs out of masks first. But in general, there is a lot of potential with that combo and others. And I think this is one of the many cards that made me look at the Yu-Gi-Oh! Set and say, huh, I think I'm going to get some of this. If we examine it through the eyes of Quadrant Theory, we know that with 3 cost, we can purchase it on turn 1 or turn 2 and also get, for example, a Canopic Jar. So it leaves options open, or if we're playing mixed, we can save a mask for Professor X. Then, when we are at parity, well, this is going to change the game. I mean, it just does. Forcing something to, you know, everything to target a specific creature or character or monster, whatever game you're playing here, is remarkable. When you're losing, those abilities all of a sudden can only target a specific thing, you know, especially if you're losing to direct damage. Not bad. And of course, when you're winning, this just provides a way of confounding your opponent's ability to claw back into the game, because a lot of those actions and abilities are simply going to be useless to them. Teams centered around putting the Ring of Magnetism uncommon on a Lord of D, I mean, it definitely has possibilities. And the fact that the Lord of D also positively impacts other dragon characters that you have means that it might be a good mesh with some of the cheaper dragons, like the baby dragon, for example. I'm not entirely sure I have a win condition worked out for that deck yet, but it's something that I'm going to be taking a look at, and I think a lot of people in the Dice Masters community are as well, at least those who have bought into the Yu-Gi-Oh! Set with some of these fantastically unique abilities that we have here. Well, until next time, this has been Taking Action. Let's get back to the rest of the show. We'll be right back. Today's feature topic focuses on something that is, well, it's not unique to this game. It's not unique to collectible games. It's, in fact, pretty applicable to a lot of life. And this is results-oriented thinking. Now, this is also talked about a lot in poker, but again, it can help you in all sorts of games and life and other things like that. So it did originate with poker, as far as I can tell, at least in terms of gaming. It was grabbed a hold of in the Magic community, and for good reason. And generally, it's a mistake that does get in the way of becoming a successful player. It tends to have a lot of use in games with either hidden information or a lot of variance. And while we don't have a lot of hidden information, we do have a lot of variance because we are dealing with dice.
Right.
And drawing them from our bag and rolling them and, yeah. But it's a problem because it focuses on what happened and not the reason why you tried it. It judges the value of a decision by what happened in the end, but a poor result doesn't mean the decision was wrong. And before we dig into this, I want to say it's not about ignoring the results entirely. It's just realizing their relative importance. Focus on the decision points in the game because those are the things you can control, and you'll get the results you want more often if you focus on the decision. If you focus on decisions and focus on making better decisions moving forward, you'll win more.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it's less about agonizing, oh, I didn't roll that, you know, two energy, I couldn't buy this guy, and that, you know, if you were aiming for that, and then you looked at your decision in terms of, you know, I need to get this guy, and then you got X, and you said, well, I didn't get what I wanted, but I could do this, and then ultimately you wind up losing, you know, you had a choice to make, you made the right choice, it just, you know, it was, you made the right choices, other things were against you, and you can't just, you know, you can't blame yourself for that. You can't necessarily blame your, you know, you, as long as the path you were thinking on, you know, I'm going to do X, Y, and Z, or given, you know, given how things are, as long as I do X, Y, and Z, that will, you know, that will let me get ahead. And right. Then if, because the dice don't roll in your favor, or there is stuff you just didn't know, if those unknown unknowns get in your way, you know, you can't get down on yourself for that. Do try to plan, you know, do try to do your best to plan for the unknown unknowns, but, you know, you can't because they're unknown unknowns.
And sometimes this could really be a help. If you're a really competitive player and you tend to get a little bit down or upset by a loss or when the randomness hit your way, like, you can take some solace in the fact, if you get better at this, you will know a little more, like, you know, realistically, I did exactly what I was supposed to do here. It's not my fault that the decision didn't work out. If you tend to have faith in the fact that you use logic and you're going to stick with that logic, then, again, law of averages, law of large numbers, it's going to come out right for you more often than not. If you can remember, this decision went badly for me, but it wasn't because of the choice that I made, then you should be able to take a little more solace in that. And aside from the decisions that you make, that'll also help the bad results that occasionally come up cloud your judgment less, because you can see them a little more dispassionately.
And on top of that, when you better understand when it was just, you know, things not working in your favor, or, you know, you made every right decision and then you still lost, it'll help you identify the cases where you don't make the right decision.
And very good, yes.
Identify your mistakes and not repeat them.
Well, in the other pitfall, I mean, we tend to frame our successes as our own genius and our losses as bad luck, because that's just what we do. And the losses really, really, they stick in our craw. They just do. You're less likely to remember the time when you made that similar decision and it went right. It takes a lot of that. Just like when they talk about the concept of a compliment sandwich when you're giving criticism, it takes a couple of positives to really outweigh the harsh impact of a negative.
Yeah.
This exactly. Well, in a similar sense here, you're going to remember that negative result a lot more often. Like look at any long-term goal. Let's say you invest in a stock and you've done your research and you are confident, like, okay, I think they have this thing is happening and something's going to work out with this and they're going to pay a dividend soon and who knows what else. And so you do all your research and you buy that stock and, you know, a couple of days later you wake up and it's down. And it's like, well, this stinks. I lost a couple hundred bucks or more and this feels really bad. And so you pull your stock and you lose money. Well, you're basing it on that one short-term result, not like the sample size of everything.
Or trends or everything. Yeah. I mean, that exact situation happened with me.
Oh, there you go.
And then if you know you're solid, you stay the course and you reap the rewards.
Yeah, because you look back and say, well, it's down right now, but I know my logic was sound, then you're fine. But yeah, well, let's say this. Evan, I'm going to offer you a bet. Okay?
Okay.
I'm going to roll. I have a 6-sided die in my hand. I'm going to roll this die. You can pick which one you'd like here. So I'm either going to roll a 1 or I'm going to roll a 2 through a 6. So if I roll a 1, it's one outcome. If I roll a 2 through 6, that's the other outcome. And you can bet $10, bet me $10 on one or the other happening. Which one would you like to take?
Well, obviously, you pick the 2 or 6 because your expected return is higher.
Well, here we go. I'm going to roll this die then. Oh, it was a 1. It looks like you should have picked 1, right?
Well... No, you should have picked 2 through 6. You just got unlucky that time.
Exactly. Because, if we do this over and over. Yeah. If we
or
do this
I
over,
should be
hundreds.
Ahead in the learn curve. I may not be, but probability-wise, I should be.
The correct choice is, of course, to take the bet. The odds are ever in your favor. But if you happen to lose, it has nothing to do with whether you should have made that decision or not.
Yes. And especially your future, in this case, is where it's just straight probability. Your future decision should not be impacted by the previous ones because that is not how probability works.
Yes, and even if the decision goes poorly a couple of times, it's important to remember that the plural of anecdote is not evidence. There's still more searching that you have to do to figure out, to get a sample size. Now, if something doesn't work right in the game and you talk with other people, they're like, yeah, I thought that was a good strategy, but it's not working for me either, and you really start to build up a volume of evidence, and then you look and examine it really within the game rules and what's its place, and you use the tools that you have available, like quadrant theory and card advantage and so forth, to figure out where this actually falls, then maybe you can start to evolve it. But that's also evolving what the logic that you're using surrounding the decision. You can take the result. Again, it's not ignoring the result, but it is recognizing its relative importance.
Right.
And it really is a question of process. So... let's apply this to Dice Masters. If you're playing a fist team and your opponent uses, say, Emma Frost against you, and you lose. So if you focus on the result, you might walk away thinking, wow, that card's pretty sweet. Maybe it's worth using. Now, we've talked a lot about why we don't think Emma Frost is particularly good, and we don't have to do that again. I mean, in general, a bad card isn't bad because it never works. It's bad because it doesn't work often enough.
Yeah.
So if you run into that a couple of times playing your fist, you're like, oh, this Emma Frost is not bad. But again, that's the result. That's not like the logical, why didn't I pick Emma Frost? Well, let's look at quadrant theory. You know, she's on the very like edge of an early game buy. If I'm winning, I mean, she's a character and that helps me in that sense. If I'm losing, she doesn't really do a whole lot unless there are fists. And in a parody, again, she's nothing more than an extra character. Well, right. She's pretty bad she's iffy to bad in two of those scenarios, and she's only
okay,
like base playable in the other two, in the sense that she's a character. Well, that's why we didn't pick her.
Right. Yeah, so, and that's why you shouldn't pick her, even if, you know, she helps whoop your butt a few times.
Yeah, a card that we don't like is never bad in every situation. Well, I mean, I guess we could find one, but generally there's always going to be a time when you could come up with a scenario where this card saves this card and its die saves the day for you. But consistency is important in these cards as well, because we're going to be playing a whole lot of games. We don't want that one scenario where everything could go right. We don't want the best case scenario. We want the average case scenario.
Right. Yeah, I mean, in my case, learning from my example, it's one thing, well, like I spoke about last week. I lost pretty badly because of Cerebro. I did have a plan for dealing with action dice, but it seemed like it was the wrong plan. So what I have to evaluate is, should I, by swapping out my Doom Caliber Soldier, which was my plan for you, dealing with action dice that are in my way, with given that it's sort of expensive and has to be on the board already, not going to help me so much about early game action shenanigans, so maybe nope. I need to consider something else.
And maybe you do.
That's maybe trying to get a little less of results-oriented and trying to think of, well, the decision to take them, maybe not, you know, yes, they fit in, yes, they're cheap, but maybe they don't actually perform the role I want them to do. So maybe I have to look at something else.
Well, and at the same time, there's two more aspects to that. First, let's say right. that we gave some respect to Cerebro in the last episode, but if you go back and listen, we were also careful to say that we're going to have to look at this a lot harder. Not, well, we should be using Cerebro now. We're not taking the result that Evan got crushed by a Cerebro, and it appeared in that context that Cerebro was very good, as a ringing endorsement of let's all use Cerebro constantly. Now, I don't think it's a bad card, and I think it's more than usable in a lot of cases, and I talked about that in our Quadrant Theory video, I believe. But in general, we didn't give that a ringing endorsement. But let's also say, too, Evan, that no deck can prepare for every eventuality as much as we'd like to be able to. So the fact that the result was that you lost doesn't necessarily mean that you need to retool that deck. So, I mean, if you can go back and examine the hard logic of what kind of a cost curve do I have, and what kind of where do the things fit in on the quadrant, and do I have like my bombs and removal and everything else and enough churn, and you can say yeah, then the logic to your team is probably solid. It just got a bad beat.
Right. It ran up with something it couldn't really deal with. I mean, I find myself asking the question, is a more active removal versus something that'll just cleanse everything? That's, I'm trying to weigh those, and I think it's going to take playing with both of them to evaluate which one is going to help me more. On the other hand, maybe it won't. So that's something I've been thinking about, weighing my options. Because it's always a constant, retooling your deck.
And it can be hard.
When you're working with something as a prototype.
And that's just a part of deck building. Right. That really is. But in general, when you come up against a case like that Cerebro, we want to look at the average case scenario for the card. So if we play with it a lot and we look at it and we do our roles and we look at the numbers and we say and we share our experiences and we have communication with other players, and it turns out that on the average, yeah, Cerebro is going to be able to throw a wrench in the works. Well, then maybe we want to consider, A, having answers for Cerebros, because it will be stronger in the meta if it is indeed the case, or B, using Cerebro in more teams.
Right.
But again, if it was a case where the best case scenario happened for your opponent and Cerebro just happened to roll exactly the right way at exactly the right time and the dice worked exactly the wrong way for you, if everything just happened to click that game or games, then we can't necessarily make a choice from that. So yeah, we don't want to look at the best case. We want to look at the average case.
Right. Yeah. Which is, I think, what I've been doing, because it also says, well, it's not just Cerebro. It's any action die that any persistent action die I have no real way of getting rid of. So, if any of them throw a wrench in the works and... Looking at D&D, I think that might be the case. I need a better plan. Yeah.
Especially if you're playing a Yu-Gi-Oh! Team, because if you square off with somebody else, there are at least two or three, maybe more, in there that are persistent. The Millennium Puzzle and so forth.
Ring of Magnetism or whatever.
Yeah, the Ring. There are a few that are persistent. And we've had some persistent ones already in the Vibranium ring, Shield, but it didn't really have much of a meta effect.
Right. So I'm thinking more and more we're seeing that, and it's like, well, cleansing might be more important than countering.
Right. So,
we'll see.
The goal, yeah. Well, and let's use another example from a game we've referenced a couple of times when you and I played, and it was Flying Sidekicks versus Villains. The decision that I made in the end of that game, which was I probably... It came down to one die roll, or I'd surely have lost. I'm confident that if I hadn't done something, I would have lost. And it worked. But if it didn't, it wasn't the wrong call. Because based on the info that I had, you were going to beat me anyway. It doesn't matter that I left myself more open to an attack if I failed, because no matter what, you were going to beat me even if I left myself open. So win or lose, it was the right choice because it gave me the best chance to continue in the game. And maybe that's an extreme case because, as I've alluded to before, in that one, it was do this or lose. Well, lose isn't really a choice. And so my only option was do this. One choice is not really a choice.
Right. But
in general, if I didn't get that roll that way, and the odds were against me getting that roll, but my odds were a low chance that I get the exact die face that I needed versus zero chance to continue.
Versus 100% chance of loss. So
exactly.
Or maybe not 100, but, 99.5 or something, because it was very obvious I would win. Things would align for me in a turn or two, and that would be that.
Right. So you're going to lose to some bad cards. It doesn't mean that they're good. And you're going to lose with a good deck. It doesn't mean that it was bad. But let's talk about the other side of this. Sometimes, let's say you're at a draft and you're mentoring another player and they put together a deck and they're like, hey, you've taught me stuff. What do you think of this? Like, imagining that wouldn't necessarily break the rules or whatever else. What do you think of this team? And you look at it and you say, well, I don't know. You don't really have options for this or this or this or this or this. And they go and they win the draft. Well, that doesn't mean that they had a good deck. You can also outperform your deck and think that it's great. Because, again, we do tend to frame our successes as our own genius. And then if he loses with it, it's bad luck. And he comes back and says, well, I won. See, it was great. Well, yeah, you did win. But that doesn't mean that you actually gave yourself the best chance to win. It just means that the way it shook out over three games, it just so happened that you found the three games out of 100 where this deck was going to work.
Right. And, maybe, yes, you did play it very skillfully. But it also may have been you had very good luck and they all had very bad luck, or that player had very good luck and this player had very bad luck, because that also factors in.
Yeah, the opponent didn't have the skill to recognize the entry points that you gave them, or who knows what else. There are a lot of ways that it could have gone, but in
or
general,
you played something so diametrically. You had the exact right card to stop them in their tracks, because, sometimes that happens.
Yeah. So the results do matter. But again, in this case, the result of winning isn't necessarily important if you can look at the deck and say, well, there is no logic to the construction of this team at all. Like, just taking the result of a small amount of games isn't valuable. You build up your sample as large as possible, and then you can judge. Just going on that one case earlier, that hypothetical case where Emma Frost beat you, is just not especially useful.
Right.
Look long term. Where results matter is over the long haul. As the rules and mechanisms and how the card is being played becomes clearer, well, now you might like that card more. We do card evaluation here frequently enough, and we're going to do it a whole lot more with the new sets that are going to be coming out, and with some of the existing stuff too, just to get our feet a little more wet with it. Early on, there's going to be a card that we're going to say, well, I don't see how that's going to really work. And then it turns out that in the wild, maybe we didn't quite grasp the rules or some of the interactions or whatever else, and we start to see that we're losing to this thing. And then other people say, like, oh, yeah, I'm seeing this happen a whole lot. And we start to run it a little bit in just experimentation or just some feeling out games. And we see, oh, we are having success with this in exactly this way. This is a really effective card. The logic can change over time, and the results can inform, was I using the right logic? But if you go back, don't look solely at the result. If you can go back and say, here's why I made this choice, and it appears to be a solid choice for these reasons, then don't second guess yourself.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it's good to iterate on your decks and work on things when you encounter problems, but don't do it in a knee-jerk fashion. If something goes wrong, really think about why it went wrong and whether or not it was a one-off thing.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and if that's the case, you don't need to modify what you're doing particularly. If it was just bad luck, if it was honestly bad luck, then, you know, that wasn't, that's not really a result. That's just randomness.
Right. I mean, it could absolutely happen that you just don't get the roll you need in several games. But if you consider how many times we're rolling dice in this game, that's a very, very small fraction. I mean, I hesitate to even refer to luck at all because, I mean, we are talking, there's so much probability here.
Right.
As you've shown us with all of your numbers-related articles, there's just so much probability here. And sometimes it doesn't work in the short term. But, again, law of large numbers, when you are sure the decisions you're making are the right ones and you're not knee-jerking to a result, then you are going to win more. And this especially helps in situations like a draft where, I mean, anytime you're building a team, there's a lot of decisions that are made. I mean, namely, should I take this card or not and why? Does this fit or not and why? But, you know, a draft, you're also like, you're picking cards that fit into a team that hasn't necessarily been built yet.
Right.
And so you really have to rely on your evaluative criteria when
you're doing
that. Especially
like a rainbow draft.
Mm-hmm.
Where,
yeah, exactly.
You know, it's not just you have all the stuff available to you at once, or you're getting a few things at a time.
Mm-hmm. You have to use your criteria. Now, at the end of the draft, you say, well, I shouldn't have taken this card. Well, before you say that because the card performed poorly or you performed poorly, look back at why you picked the card.
Right.
And
if your reasons for taking it were sound, you know, and, you know, if you wound up taking, you know, oh, I took a bunch of fists because they're good, solid cards, and then everybody played Emma Frost, you know, that's
a lot of Emma Frost.
Yeah, well, no, it's unlikely, but it could happen.
Or, you'd look across the board and you'd see a lot of very pretty dice, at least.
Yeah.
Very true.
Absolutely.
Yeah, so, well, again, this is not just for this game. This is for every game. And I think it's pretty obvious why this originates in poker. Because, I mean, poker, it looks a lot at basic strategy and different things like that. And from talking to people who do like poker a lot, you can talk to a person who's attempting to play poker professionally, and they're like, well, why are you doing this? It's like, well, I went to my brother dragged me to a tournament. I didn't really know what I was doing at the casino, and I won. And so I figured, that opens the door for me. Well, you didn't have a clue how or why you were making these decisions. It doesn't mean you were good at making those decisions. It just meant that that day something was on. That day the probability happened to work for you. It doesn't really mean that it will for ever. And same thing here. The dice working or not working doesn't mean you can make a bad choice and it comes out really good because you happen to hit a run where you're doing better than what the average probability would tell you you should be getting. And that's, you can't rely on that. Again, why you need to look at the average case scenario. Well, and that's where we said rot. We don't want this to rot your mind. We don't want results-oriented thinking to be in your mind. Again, not saying the results don't matter, but just that they matter less than the reasons that you made the choice in the first place. So let us know what you think. Let us know if you've seen this shape your behavior in this game or other games. I know that I can be prone to it, like in Summoner Wars, when it's like, okay, I'm attacking this, and I think this will work. I have this strategy, and then I don't hit. And it's like, well, I didn't hit. Does that mean that what I was doing was bad? If I can think like that, I'll get less mad at Summoner Wars. So, in any case, follow us on Twitter. Give us reviews on iTunes. It does help us get the word out there. And check out our website, our YouTube channel. Plenty of ways to interact with us. Of course, we have all of our first names, Dave, Evan, Randy, or Chris, at thereservepool.com. We'd love to hear from you. Thank you so much for spending your time with us. This is Dave.
And this is Evan.
And this has been The Reserve Pool. One, two, three.
Three.
Cool. One day that joke will stop being funny, but that day is not today.
But yeah, that day is not today.